You know, people think I'm cheap. That's ridiculous. There's even somebody cheaper. Here comes the Colonel.
Oh, yes, these comedians who sneak in here and interrupt a serious science program. All right, welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In the first half hour, you heard us speak with the very exciting historian and geneticist Adam Rutherford, who wrote A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. Back to him in just a minute. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments are the voice of reason. Right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set to answer today's queries. Let me turn on the clean jar just a bit here, and here comes.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Ah, yes, indeed. We have awakened the spirit of the fountain because we threw in the coins. The spirit of the fountain who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. All right, O spirit of the fountain, what historic island hideaway is the last inhabited British territory in the Pacific? And the clue, O spirit of the fountain, is historic island and hideaway. The last inhabited British territory in the Pacific. What is the name of that island, O Spirit of the Fountain?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell.
Aha! The Spirit of the Fountain knows. The historic island hideaway as the last inhabited British territory in the Pacific. Yes, if you said Pitcairn Island, you're quite correct. It is, and you may remember, that's the island that the Mutiny on the Bounty, the mutineers, escaped to after they had the Mutiny on the Bounty. All right, back to our program. With noted geneticist Adam Rutherford, author of A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, a guest on our program, and you mentioned, and I want you to clarify this, you mentioned that the Pope has come out and said that evolution is not a theory, that it really does exist. And you took issue with that because you wanted to point out that theory is really very, very important. So many people believe that theory is just supposition, put together with a few things, and that there isn't really much in the way of proof. But you wanted to drive it home that theory is very important, like mathematics is theory, and yet we send people to Mars or send vehicles so far to Mars and people to the moon using mathematics. So would you please nail that down? Tell us, you know, what is theory?
Yeah, so the problem that you're describing, this is a fault of science. It's terribly annoying that the word theory, when we talk about it, and you know, colloquially in the street, means something specifically different from how we use the word theory in science. And it's been the root cause of many issues in getting, you know, good science out there and into the public. So it was John Paul. I come from a Catholic family, and it was John Paul II who said evolution is more than just a theory, because sometimes people who attack evolution say, you know, it is just a theory, there are other theories available, right? The problem, it was great that John Paul said that. It was a, you know, real step forward in the long and mostly happy but sometimes fractious relationship between religion and science, and particularly the Catholic, the Vatican, the Holy See, and science. So it was really positive that he did that, but he fell into, in doing so, he fell into one of the traps of talking about science and talking about theory, which is, when we say theory in the street, we mean, you know, it's a guess. We're making an intelligent guess about something. My theory is that if I look out the window now and it's raining, then it's probably October in London. Actually, that's more than a theory, it's always raining in London. So that's how we talk about it in the street. But in science, when we say theory in science is absolutely the absolute top of the pile of ideas of how we structure our thoughts and our ideas. So when we talk about the law of gravity, gravity is a real thing. We have loads of evidence to suggest that gravity works in a particular way. Theory goes above that in the hierarchy. So a theory is a description of reality that is based on stacks of evidence, stacks of experimental evidence. It's been tested and tested and tested, and all ideas within those tests point to one singular idea. And in the case of the theory of evolution by natural selection, there is just overwhelming evidence that that evolution by natural selection is the mechanism by which life on Earth spread around the planet, and why we see creatures and organisms and plants and us the way we do today. So it's saying it's just a theory is a misunderstanding of what theory means in science. It doesn't mean it's a guess, or it's a, you know, I'm just trying to figure this out, or even that it's an intelligent guess. A theory in science is as close to a description of reality that we can manage. So it was great when the Pope said that, but he tripped himself up there by not pointing that out. So I'm still grateful that John Paul II said that.
That's sensational. Well, thank you so much for nailing it down. That nailed it down. And of course, here in the States, we have a lot of religious fundamentalists. I don't know if you have that condition there in the UK or in Europe, but there are whole numbers of people that believe that there are human footprints right alongside the dinosaur footprint. We have dinosaur footprints here in Texas. And there are those who have a whole display up showing human beings with the dinosaurs to support the biblical, assertion that the first creatures were Adam and Eve, and they just all of a sudden appeared. So do you have that condition there in the UK too, these silly people?
Yeah, it does. Young Earth creationists do exist in the UK. It's not as much of a problem as it is in the US, I think. And you know, the unfortunate thing about people who assert that view is that because it's so distant from what scientists think and what most people think, and in fact what most Christians think, it gets a lot of airtime and a lot of play. Because people like to, you know, say, well, in the media, and I work in the media, you know, if you want to debate, you want sparks to fly between two people on a TV program or on a radio program, you put one person who thinks one thing, and you put one person who thinks completely the opposite, and you let them duke it out. The fact of the matter is that, you know, almost all Christians in this country are not young Earth creationists. They do believe in God, in the Judeo-Christian God. But they also are very, very willing to accept that evolution is real, that the Earth is very old, that the many, many strands of scientific evidence that we've accumulated over the last couple of centuries point to a singular theory of evolution in a scientific sense, and that there is no credible scientific evidence to support the Earth being 6,000 years old, or that humankind's are the product of the pairing of two people, or that dinosaurs coexisted with humans. In fact, the evidence suggests that. Yeah, I love this fact. It's kind of mind bending. But Tyrannosaurus rex is closer in time to us humans, 65 million years, than it is to stegosauruses. Right? So, you know, two of the iconic dinosaurs. The dinosaurs lived for so long that we're actually nearer to them in chronological time and Tyrannosauruses were to Stegosauruses. So anyway, I just like that because it's a great factoid for kids at parties. But anyway, the point was, there's such an absence of evidence for a young Earth creationist model. But because it stands so far opposed from what scientists think, it gets a lot of play in the media. And the media love that. They love the fight, and they love the fact that people get riled by this, and scientists get very annoyed by this. In fact, at least in this country, creationism is kind of like it's sort of fringe. It's a fringe within Christianity. And I know many Christians. I know many Christian scientists. I know many Christian evolutionary biologists, and they think it's absurd as well. So it's just a pity it gets so much airtime. I think you guys in the States have a deeper problem when it comes to creationism than we do over here. But still, you know, it's, controversy gets airtime, and that's a pity.
Yeah, well, of course, the one of the things the Christians don't like is that there is no evidence that a Jesus ever existed. And we've not been able to produce any evidence that a Jesus ever existed. It seems that he's turning out to be a combination of a lot of different people that they kind of sewed together with different philosophical ideas. So and Christians have a hard time with that. The other thing that we've got a hard time in this country is racism. I mean, there are very active neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan people that seem to feel encouraged by Donald Trump, our current president, and loathe the fact that Donald Trump's beautiful daughter is married to a Jew. So I would hope that your book will be widely read and people understand these things. You point out so well, I really love it, it's so elementary, because you point out that I have two parents, and that means that I have four grandparents, and that means I have eight great-grandparents, and we can extrapolate that out to, I think you pointed out, like 5,000 or 6,000 years to show that everybody's really related to everybody.
Yeah, incredibly closely related, and it is, it's one of the reasons that that genealogy, which is the big, is singularly the biggest, most popular hobby in the United States. Mm. In the UK, it's second to gardening. I don't know why that says about the difference between Brits and Americans. But genealogy is big business, and it's a big deal all around the world, notably in the US. We tend to think about it wrong. We tend to not think about what you just said, which is that the number of ancestors that we have doubles every time you go back a generation into the past. And I mean, you know, sexual reproduction is an incredibly inefficient thing, biologically speaking. It takes two organisms to make one. If you're a bacteria, it takes one organism to make another one, which is a much more efficient way of going about things. But the notion that the number of ancestors that we have doubles every time we go back in time is offset against this other fact, this other annoying fact, which is that there are more people alive today than at any other point in history. So those look like they shouldn't work together, because one is saying the number of ancestors you have goes up as you go back in time, but the number of people who have ever lived is going up as you move forward in time. And the answer is kind of obvious when you think about it, which is you have to cram the number of ancestors you have into the total number of people who existed at that time. And what that means is when you go back in time, when you go back through the generations, you come to a point where there are multiple positions on your family tree that are occupied by the same person. Now, that is, we call it inbreeding, but we're not talking about inbreeding where, you know, very close family members have married each other, which is it produces its own problematic effects within in genetics. Interestingly, you know, we talk about first cousin marriages quite a lot. In the UK, first cousin marriages have been legal since Henry VIII. In the States, first cousin marriages are not legal in, I think from memory, 30 states. So I'm not talking about those immediate family relations in inbreeding. I'm just talking about as further you go back in time, it turns out that our branches on our family trees begin to cross through the same people. And if you extend this mathematically back through time, you start getting to some sort of weirdly impressive numbers, and I think they're quite shocking. So one of them is that the most recent common ancestor of all Europeans is only in the 14th century, or the beginning of the 15th century, 1400. So this is a calculation done about 3 years ago. And what that means is that if we could draw the family tree, the complete family tree of every single individual in the whole of Europe, there would be one line on every single person's family tree that would cross through one individual person in the year 1400, which is crazy to think about.
Yeah.
I mean, I find that absolutely sort of bewildering in terms of the scope, but it's mathematically true, and it has to be true. And so, you know, what it's saying is we're actually terribly closely related. You're on the phone, so I don't have a picture of what you look like, but you have relatively recent European ancestry, I'm guessing, do you?
Yes, as best that I've been able to tell from my mother and father is that I've got some French and English. My name is Mason, which is a nice old English name, and some Norse and some Irish. So that seems to be it. But reading your book, I find out that really I'm far more complicated than that. And that's perfect. Okay.
Well, it's perfect for what I'm about to say, which is basically that almost certainly means that you and I are something like fourth or fifth cousins, maybe sixth, right? And I know it sounds kind of crazy, but basically, well, everyone on Earth is only about a 20th cousin of everyone else. But the fact that you've identified, you know, from your family genealogy that you have recent European, British, French, Irish ancestry, and I have all of those as well, and some Scandinavian as well, because we have those similar ancestries to each other, it probably means that we're probably fourth or fifth, maybe sixth cousins.
And we're both Neanderthals, is that right? We're both Neanderthals.
Yeah, well, if you go back as far as that, and everyone in Europe, the ancestors of everyone in Europe, had close relationships with Neanderthals, and we carry their DNA to this day. So, again, assuming you've got European ancestry, which you just told me you have, you've got probably between 1% and 2% Neanderthal DNA in your genome. And that's the same for everyone who has European ancestry in the whole of America. So, yeah, you know, we should try and get it out of our heads that Neanderthals were sort of, you know, thuggish grunting cavemen. They were, all the evidence suggests they were, you know, as sophisticated as us, as culturally adept as we were at that time. They were probably always a very small population, and never very diverse. And that may be part of the reason that we ended up overtaking them, and they became extinct, and we did not. But their legacy, we carry it, me and you.
And that's fascinating. And the other thing is that all this said now that you've gone through explains why you take a pretty dim view of the ancestry tabletop stuff that is being advertised all the time about trace back, you know, your origins. Because really, we would trace back our origins, if we could, back to amoebas or something like that. So you take a dim view of the industry that's going on right now of tracing ancestors.
I do. It's qualifiedly dim, in the sense that the data that's being generated is robust, it's good. It's really about the analyses that follow that data. And I think that many people who buy these tests, which is now millions, you know, so that it's dominated by a few big companies, and on the whole, you know, they're good companies. But I think that a lot of people are buying them with a slight misunderstanding of what it is the data can actually tell you. And the reason I say that is because there isn't a scientific method for identifying where your DNA has come from in the past. We just don't have that. That isn't a thing that exists. And so what those tests are actually showing is where DNA similar to yours can be found on Earth today, right? So when it says, when you do one of those tests and you get a map, nice map, pretty map back, saying you're 4% Swedish or 50% Indian or whatever it is, what they're actually saying is 50% of your DNA is common in India, or 4% of your DNA is common in Sweden. And there's an assumption. We then make an assumption, a sort of narrative completeness assumption, which says, well, if 4% of my DNA is common in Sweden, therefore I have Swedish ancestry. It's not an unreasonable assumption to make, but it's not one that is sort of necessarily scientifically true. it could, I say this in the book, and it's to be deliberately obtuse, but to prove a point, is that if you, let's just imagine that the entire population of Sweden moved to Sweden on January the 15th, 1975, so the day before I was born. Then at the age of 40, I have a genetic test, and it says 10% of your genome is from Sweden. It could be, it doesn't say anything about the history of Sweden at all there. It doesn't recognize the fact that the entire population of Sweden moved in the day before I was conceived. Now, I know that isn't what happened in Sweden, but the point is that there isn't a method for saying where your DNA has come from in the past. I get a lot of, you mentioned neo-Nazis, I get a lot of correspondence from people who are beginning to use these tests in a way which is sort of about identity politics. It's about establishing, trying to establish, a personal identity. Where do I fit into the big picture? Mostly, it is people who are doing it for fun, for trivial reasons. Everyone wants to find out that they're descended from Vikings because Vikings are really cool. Unfortunately, every European is descended from Vikings. So, finding out you've got 4% Swedish DNA is, if you think that's cool, then good for you. But it is literally true for every European. Everyone with pale skin is descended from Vikings, and also from Jews, and also from Saracens, and Huns, and Muslims, and so on. It's kind of trivial. It's kind of fun. It's sort of scientifically meaningless and problematic. The problem arises when you get neo-Nazis who are using these tests to affirm their racial superiority. I have correspondence with people who think this a lot. Occasionally, you come across a story where neo-Nazis or far-right people have done genetic tests, and they'd reveal that they have recent African ancestry, that they were unaware of, or recent Jewish ancestry. It's difficult not to laugh at them at this point, because the level of misunderstanding of genetics in order to prove a point about their own superiority results in them revealing quite the opposite of something they feel comfortable with.
Yes, Adam Rutherford, the author of A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, the human story retold through our genes. You've been just a fascinating guest, and I can't thank you enough for taking your time and so generous to be with us today and to explain these things. I can recommend this book to anybody. It is a fascinating history going back 100,000 years to the present, and it really reveals some incredible information. So, Adam, thank you so much for being with us.
It is my absolute pleasure. I've spent as much time in the U.S. as possible, but I've never been to Texas. It looks like I'm going over to Kansas in a few months, but at some point I'm going to make it down to you guys.
You'll love it, and be sure to visit the Alamo. That's our holy grail here in Texas.
Absolutely.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I think it was Harry Pratchett, another famous Briton, who said that human stupidity is more than a match for artificial intelligence. My name is Matthew Hawes. I'm a go-to-market solution specialist specializing in model-based systems engineering, and I'm an engineering fellow at PTC.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.